in Romans chapter 15. There is an important verse. And for this season, as we look at the book of Zechariah, it's probably more important than ever because Paul tells us this, that whatever was written in former days, that's all this part of the Bible, was written for our instruction. That is, there are things that we need to learn, that we need to be taught, that through endurance and through the encouragement of the scriptures, we might have hope. So I think Paul's painting a little picture. He's saying, God has spoken, and when we learn it well, there are two effects, right? One is we can endure when things are hard. The other is that we can be encouraged in the ways we need. And the effect is when others look in, they go, that's what hope looks like. Because you are still, you're encouraged and you're enduring, even when sometimes life is hard. And the reason I point it out is because Paul has told us that's the aim of all the things that were written, including an odd book in the Old Testament that probably we don't spend much time in, that we're spending our fall in together, this book of Zechariah. And our aim today is to get from verse 7 of chapter 1 to the end of chapter 2, and we will fail. I know this because we already failed once in first service, and we will do it again in second. But that's all right. There's always another Sunday, and that's a good thing. But we're just going to keep working our way through this book. And even if you were sitting here as Melissa was reading scripture going like, what is going? Nighttime visions and horses and speckled horses and patrols and what on earth is happening? We're going to try to unpack that a little bit together. But before we do, let me just kind of recap and kind of set the scene again so that we kind of, I just want to make sure we're kind of in the right headspace as we open up to this fantastic and important little book. I want you to try to think of a scenario like this, and it might not be exactly this, but I want you to make sure you're feeling the right feeling, which sounds kind of funny, but have you ever had one of those Christmases, don't put up your hand because you're probably sitting next to your family, when you just had immense hope, like you're really looking forward to it. It was going to be so fantastic, and you were very hopeful of what it was going to feel like. And then Christmas Day arrived, and it just didn't quite feel the way you thought. Your expectations were up here, and the reality was way down here. Or maybe it's not Christmas. Maybe that one doesn't do it for you. Maybe it was a vacation, a family vacation. You had planned and saved and prepared, and you were so excited. And then you went on vacation. It's like, it was good. It rained more than you thought, and the bed wasn't comfortable, but Or maybe it was like that dream job where you just knew, it's like, if when I land that job, the first day on that job, because that's what I've so looked for, it's going to be awesome. And then it was kind of more like the job you just had. If you, whatever that feeling is, if you could put that feeling, pardon the expression, but kind of put that feeling on steroids for a moment, you're probably going to be able to feel a little bit of, I think, where Israel was at this moment in their history. They had been in exile, and by exile, it's like they had been taken by a foreign empire from their homes forcibly, some killed, brutalized, moved hundreds, in some cases thousands of miles away, settled, and they had lived as slaves for 70 years with the hope that one day God would take them home. And then, in spectacular, miraculous fashion, God takes the heart of a king, bends it to his ways. You can read about it in Ezra chapter 1. His name was Cyrus the Great. And Cyrus, out of the blue, makes a declaration that the people of Israel will be allowed to go home. There's no advantage particularly for him. We looked a little bit of last week of some of the reasons he might have done it, but compared to the advantage of keeping them as his slaves, it made no sense for him to do what he did, but he did it nonetheless. And Ezra looks and goes, that's God doing that. 43-ish thousand people returned to Israel. That's a small minority of those who had gone into exile. Most stayed back in Babylon, Persia, that area. But some went home. And you can kind of, can you kind of picture the jubilation of what that must have felt like? It's like, we are finally going back home. Many of them would have never actually have seen it. They just heard about it. Heard about this unique place that God had given them. where there they could commune with God, where there they would be free, where they would have their own homes, their own country. And they arrived home in the year 537. They started to build. Fantastic joy and excitement. Many of those that went back, if you read the list that we get mainly in Ezra, Nehemiah also speaks to this. So gals who are in the midweek women's Bible study, you're going to get kind of another piece of the picture kind of all fitting together in this. But many of those who went back were from the priestly families. In other words, the group of the nation of Israel that God had assigned them a specific role of leading the nation in worship and encountering God, they would have never actually been able to do their job. Can you imagine that? For years, sitting there going, I was called by God to lead the people of God to worship him. And I've never had the chance, but now we are going home and I will finally be able to do the thing I was born for. They get back, they start to build, they even lay the foundation of the temple in 536. And then the wheels fall off. There's division within the camp, within the nation. Some want to press ahead with building the temple. Others are saying it's just too expensive. It's too costly. We need to get busy building our own homes. We need to plant our own crops. And how are we supposed to take the money that we need for our families to give to build the temple? Like, it's just, the whole thing is impossible. And then there started to be persecution from outside. The Samaritans who live 50 miles away start actually lobbying Persia to stop it. And Persia is in the middle of some strange conflict. And for a while, it's just all up in the air. Then in the year 530, Cyrus the Great dies and he leaves his son, who is a madman, in charge of the nation. And he, for 10 years, wreaks havoc. And everything in Israel just is at a standstill. The dream of this glorious return and hope and homecoming is just, it's vanishing. It's like it's slipping through their fingers. And they just sort of slip further and further into despondency. The year 520 is when Darius takes over the nation of Persia and he reissues the order that Israel can rebuild. And God sends a prophet by the name of Haggai, and you can read about him in just right before the book of Zechariah. And Haggai preaches two sermons in sort of August, September, early October of the year 520. And he essentially says, Israel, it's time to get busy. You need to rebuild your temple. But he issues some curious warnings. And this, we're not studying Haggai, but read it sometime because it helps kind of set the scene. Part of what he's concerned about is that just because you build a temple, it won't necessarily make you clean. You remember how Jesus would often talk about, like, you know, he's not made dirty by things that make others dirty. It's almost like sin. We've talked about this before. Forgive the bad analogy. Sin's kind of like cooties, so you can catch it. It was that kind of idea, the structure built into how the law was playing itself out. But you can be made dirty by touching things that were unclean, but you couldn't be made clean by touching things that were clean, right? That was kind of the gist of it in a very simplified, sort of dumbed down sort of idea. And so Haggai is saying, just because you're going to build a temple that's going to be clean, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be clean. And then that fall, a drought hits Israel, and it's a catastrophic drought. And their crops are failing, the rains don't come. And God sends the next messenger, his name is Zechariah. And in the late part of October or into early November of the year 520, he preaches a very short sermon. We looked at it last year, and the gist of it is this: return to me, and I will return to you. Which is an odd message for the very people who had returned. I tried to point that out last year. Like, if you had been one of those ones who had gone back to Jerusalem, that must have just felt weird. It's like, well, we are the returners. We paid the price. We left comfort and familiarity, and we journeyed back, and we're doing the hard thing, and it hasn't gone well, and the nation is not what it was. It used to be this big area, and it's shrunk down by Persia, and they have no king, and they have no army, and they're not even a nation. And if you look at Nehemiah chapter 9, where Nehemiah reflects on this moment, he says, you want to know what? We're still slaves. We're not home. Like, oh, we're physically there, but who are we kidding? This is not freedom. This is not the liberation we hoped for. They had such high hopes. And Zechariah's message there, return to me, it's almost like he's saying, you can return to the right place. You can be in the right physical spot. Doesn't mean you've returned to God. You can attend a church. Doesn't mean you've returned to God. If you read Deuteronomy chapter 30, there's an interesting little scene where God anticipates these moments coming. And he says, return to me and obey me. That's just an interesting thing when he partners those, because I think for many of us, like the idea of return or repentance is obedience, but it's almost like Deuteronomy is saying there are two important things. Yes, it's important to obey the Lord. Please don't hear me say that isn't important. But to return to him is actually another thing. It's loving him and trusting him and fellowshipping with him and having a relationship with him. And God says, I want both. I don't just want you to go through a checklist of obedience things, but not have actually entered into fellowship with me. I want you both. So Zechariah preaches this little sermon that fall. He caps it off with this little message in verse 5 where he says, where are your fathers? Where are the prophets? The answer is they're all dead. But my word is still alive and well. That's kind of the gist of the end of his sermon. And then we find out in verse 6 what happens. The last part, so they repented. And if you look into the rest of chapter 1, you'll find out that God returns to them. And we have this incredible moment. So here's how the rest of the book's going to function. What does God do? What is the sort of comfort? How does God interact with his people when they actually return to him? That's what makes Zechariah such an awesome book, because it's so full of encouragement and instruction of who God is and how he functions when we say, you want to know what, Lord? I trust you and I love you. And yeah, I'm going to stumble. I'm not going to do this perfectly, but I'm going to return. Now, what does God do in response? And for the next 14 chapters, you're going to see the answer to that question, because you're going to see who God is. He's going to instruct you on what he does and when his people return. So he's going to do it through a series of visions. There's going to be 8 of them, 3 that we're going to look at quick this morning, beginning in verse 7 of chapter 1, all the way to somewhere in chapter 2 till we run out of time. So the visions, we're told, come on the 24th day of the 11th month, which is the month of Shabbat in the second year of Darius. That gives us, we're a few months after the first sermon. So we're actually on February 15th of the year 519. For those who like to know the precise things, we can actually date it because we know how the lunar calendar that Darius is following in Persia lines up with our calendar. And so we are at an interesting point in the calendar. Interesting, not because it's the day after Valentine's Day, because I don't think they're doing that yet, but it's interesting because we're a week away from New Year's Day. Again, not our New Year's, I get this. Our New Year's is, you know, like the end of December, start of January. You go back 2,500 years ago, New Year's is at a different point in the calendar. And the reason that's important, I think, for our moment in history is because everyone in this day knew what you'd do on New Year's Day. Now, we do something different. We do resolutions. That's kind of what people do. It's like, oh, it's New Year's. Probably should lose another 10 pounds. The 10 pounds I didn't lose last year, right? And I should start reading more, and I should improve myself. That's how we treat New Year's. New Year's 2,500 years ago is when you rebuilt or built temples. It's just, everyone knew that. You didn't have, it was just given knowledge. And I think it's kind of important because that's the backdrop of this moment. They, in their minds, they would have been thinking of the temple they're supposed to be building, all those kind of things. And now we are at the precise moment in the calendar when that's what we should have been doing. And at that moment, God speaks through a series of visions. A vision's different than a dream, right? Dream is when you're asleep. A vision is he's wide awake, but at night, and the Lord speaks. And here's the first of the 3. In the night, I saw a man riding a red horse, standing among myrtle trees in the glen. And then behind him, a series of other horses. And that's the initial scene. Now, what would that mean? In fact, you're actually going to see Zechariah's going to ask that very question. It's like, what is this? Because it's not initially obvious to him. Now, I think there would have been a few things that would have been obvious. One is this looks very ominous. This is a very threatening scene. A horse in the ancient world is not, it was different, right? You didn't own a horse to go trail riding or to have a pony or any of those things. A horse was a military machine. Our equivalent today would be like a tank. That's why God keeps saying to his people, some trust in horses and some in chariots, but you need to trust in me. Right? Because that's what it is. So now we have this scene. They're in a glen, so a valley, and they're among myrtle trees, and it's at night, and you've got this very ominous scene, and there's a bunch of tanks parked there, hiding in the trees. You get the feel? I think that's probably where Zechariah is like, what's going on here? Now the answer comes through an angel who is going to help him understand it. The man, this is verse 10, standing among the myrtle trees answered, "These are they whom the Lord has sent to patrol the earth." So, okay, so now we have a little piece of the puzzle. There is some sense that this is a group who are doing the work of God. Now, I'm not going to spend a lot of time trying to hypothesize of what the meaning of the horses are. I've read oodles of different ideas. I'm not sure that any one of us could actually totally with precision say, well, the red horse means this and the speckled horse means that. I think the big picture sense of what's going on here is that these are animals that usually represented knowledge, because the Persian Empire, by the way, is doing this exact thing. Darius actually is the one who builds the world's first superhighway. Spreads all the way from Pakistan right to the Mediterranean. It's fantastic. He essentially starts the Pony Express, kind of like the ancient version. He uses a lot of horses, and they are military, but they can patrol the whole kingdom. And so he can keep track of what's going on. But we find out in this that these represent the patrol of God. In other words, God's saying, it's like, if you're worried for a second about Darius and the Persian Empire and him kind of keeping tabs on everything, God is way beyond that. He knows everything. It's almost like a picture of God's omniscience, his all-knowing. He just knows everything. And that's what this little scene is representing to us, at least in part, maybe even in main part. Now, there's one other detail that just I'll throw it out there as we walk our way through here. The myrtle tree. I actually think that piece is as probably more significant than the color of the horses, because myrtle trees actually do have meaning. If you go back into the Old Testament, often trees, there's a connotation with trees, right? You think of like the cedars of Lebanon or the oaks of Bashan. Like they show up in poetry and in literature, and they always kind of have there's a picture. It's like, oh, the cedars of Lebanon, they're huge and vast and powerful, and the oaks of Bashan are strong. What is a myrtle tree? Well, a myrtle tree is more like a shrub. It grows 6 to 12 feet. It's very fragrant. In fact, so fragrant that typically in a wedding bouquet, that's what you would put, the branches of a myrtle tree, for its fragrance. It was a lovely smelling thing. In fact, so lovely and kind of a happy connotation that many families named their daughters the name of a myrtle tree, Hadassah, right? If you know Esther's story, you're like, oh, hold on a second. That's where that comes from. That's the background. And even in the prophets, when they speak of a myrtle tree, it's always with a feeling of like joyful reversal. So Isaiah will talk of a myrtle tree. He's like, instead of briars, you're going to have myrtles. Briars are prickly, thorny things. You're going to have myrtles, this wonderful, good, fragrant thing. It's this picture of reversal. It was bad, and now it's good. And so here we are in this scene where at first we feel like ominous threat of this group hidden in this group of trees, but now it's coming out, and it's like, hold on a second. This is a joyful, happy scene, and it's fragrant because this is God, and he's at work. Now, we find out they have patrolled all the earth, and here's the report back in verse 11. We have patrolled the whole earth, and behold, the earth remains at rest. And you would think, it's like, well, isn't that what we all want? Just like, there's probably a lot of days, it's like, if I could just slip in an hour of rest here. Now, it's interesting because in verse 12, we get the response of the angel to that report. Here it is. The angel of the Lord, verse 12, said, "O Lord of hosts, how long will you have no mercy on Jerusalem?" Isn't that a funny That's a funny response. The angels, the patrol says, the whole earth is at rest. And the angel's like, oh, how long until you show mercy? Like, you see how those don't seem to fit? So what's going on with the picture? Well, the picture, the reason it doesn't fit is because we've read it wrong. Rest is not like peace. Rest is just quiet. And if you know kind of how the prophets often speak of this, they speak of the fact when Israel is going to finally be freed or liberated, it will become because God shakes the nations. God is going to have to cause violent upheaval in the nations so that his people will be freed. And so the report of these riders who are patrolling the earth coming back and saying the whole earth is quiet. That's actually the word they use, not shalom or any other word for peace, but quiet. Everything's quiet. It's not a good report. That's a report that the nations are still not in upheaval. God's people are still not seeing liberation. That's why the angel says, how long until you show them mercy? So we just kind of have to read it right and make sure we're picturing the right thing as we go through this. Now, God finally speaks into this whole situation, and we find out that there's two things true of God. If you look in verse 14 and 15, one, I am exceedingly jealous for Jerusalem. Two, I'm exceedingly angry at the nations. In fact, it's like, I am jealous with a great jealousy is the statement, and I am angry with a great anger. It's like, I'm really angry, and I'm really jealous. Now, the jealousy is a good jealousy. It's not our kind. Usually our jealousy is a sinful one, where we see what someone else has and we want it, and it just turns petty really quick. This is the healthy jealousy of a proper relationship, where if you are married, there probably ought to be a sense of jealousy for your spouse, that if you saw someone else showing them like wrong affection and attention, something inside you would stir and go, that doesn't feel right. That's what God is doing. He is jealous towards his people because he has a love for them. That when he sees their affection heading in the wrong direction or an ill affection heading towards theirs, something stirs within him. And so he says, I have watched the nations go beyond what I had told them to do in the punishment of Israel. God had used the nations to discipline his people. Now, the discipline was also, if you read the prophets right, was also to teach them who God was and eventually to teach the nations who he was. So it was the whole thing. There was a teaching component. Yes, a discipline for their sin, but in the end, the outworking of the exile and all those things was that they were going to finally learn who the Lord was. And they would be able to return to him and finally know him. And then because of that, the nations who would watch all this happen might also come to know him. And so God says, I am jealous and I am angry. Look at why he's angry. They're at ease. For a little while, I was angry, but a little, but they furthered the disaster. In other words, the other nations went way beyond what I had called them to. And so there's going to be discipline. There's going to be disaster, actually. And this first scene ends with this note that God is going to be merciful to Jerusalem. He's going to restore his people, and he will ultimately bring them comfort. And I think there is a temporal sense that that's going to be fulfilled and a future sense. It's like when you look at, have you ever kind of been maybe driving or hiking? Hiking actually is the worst. And you look at a series of sort of ridges, and you're going to hike to the top of that mountain. Have you ever had this experience? And you hike, and 2 hours later, you get to the top, and it's like, oh, my goodness. Look, there's more beyond it. It's that kind of sense that when the prophets look into the future, they see, you can kind of see as you're reading the various peaks, but there's layers beyond. And so there is a temporal fulfillment. God actually at this moment in history is restoring his people, but there is a future fulfillment. In fact, Revelation 21 and 22 will speak of a new Jerusalem where God is going to fulfill this in an ultimate sort of way. So there's kind of these layers that you have to keep in mind as we go through it. But the big picture point, I think, of the first vision is learning something about the character of God and the purposes of God, and that is that he will bring peace. Persia has brought a quiet, but God one day will bring peace. And I don't know the situation all of you are in. I know many of you. I can look out and it's like, I know lots of stories of challenging things you're going through. And you're probably like, maybe like Zechariah. It's like, how long? Like, will he? The answer is yes. But like Zechariah, we need to be a people who learn to look up and see. Because that's the underlying message of the whole book. If we keep our eyes just on this plane of just looking around at what's going on and who's doing what and what happens in your daytime and all those things, and you miss the fact that from a different plane, from the vantage point of God, he is also at work in ways that you couldn't even begin to fathom. You'll miss most of what's going on in this world. That's actually the nature of this literature. We talked about apocalyptic literature last week. It's using word pictures to paint descriptions of our world from the vantage point of God. And so you see this first picture of how God sees it. He's like, I know everything going on, and one day I will bring comfort. Okay, second scene, verse 18. And this is the classic phrase, the first time we see the classic phrase of Zechariah. And I lifted up my eyes and saw. And I would say to you, until you start lifting up your eyes to see the world from God's perspective, you're missing most of it. Sometimes for me, that's helpful if there's something hard going on in my own life, just to stop and just start remembering that God is at work. I don't know always how or to what end. And sometimes I try to just imagine, it's like, I wonder what God might be accomplishing through this hard thing, that I would much rather just go away. I don't know if you've ever done that. It's like, well, you know, I might be going through this trial, but someone might see this. And for them, that might be significant in their own faith, or I might learn something that I might have ever learned that will prepare me for a trial that's coming later, that if I wasn't prepared for it, it would really knock me off my step and trust in the Lord. There could be countless things, or God might just take this hard thing and use it for a good purpose. My wife is always so great at this. If I get stuck in traffic, I don't know how many times she's told me over the years, it's like, Don, you don't know how many times the Lord might have spared you in an accident. But apply that in life, right? This hard thing might be being used by God as an interruption that would spare us further grief. But we know God is at work, and he is ultimately going to bring peace and comfort. So, second, I lift my eyes and saw, and behold, four horns. And I said to the angel who talked with me, what are these? I'm like, that is a good question. Thank you, Zechariah, for asking it. Because if I had a vision and saw four horns, I think I might be going, what on earth is going on? Now, normally, if you think of horns, they are attached to something, right? They're attached to an animal. I've been to the rodeo, not much, because I'm not a big crowd person, and everyone seems to want to go to the rodeo all at once. But they're attached to an animal. It's what makes them ominous or threatening. If they're just hanging on a wall, I've never looked at that and go, oh, I feel in danger. It's like, it's just a thing on the wall. It's an object. But this one seems to bring an element of danger or concern. He sees these four horns. What are these? And he said to me, these are the horns that have scattered Judah, Israel, and Jerusalem. Now, again, like the four horses, there has been a lot of work done to try to figure out, okay, what do these horns represent? Do they represent specific nations or kingdoms? I've come to the conclusion that when we try to, if we get too much into that, we're going to miss the big picture piece. It is entirely possible that they represent countries, but it's hard if you're thinking of Israel and Judah to come up with a list of what the four would be. Clearly, Assyria would be in the list and Babylon would be in the list. Maybe you could make Medo-Persia in the list, but Medo-Persia didn't scatter Israel. Medo-Persia actually helped them back. And so then we typically have to look at places like Edom and Philistia, which didn't actually have a key role in the scattering, and it just becomes a very hard exercise. I can see why we would do it and why you'd be curious, but let me just suggest to you that maybe the more important thing is to step back and just say, the picture being painted is the fact that the nations of this world, represented by the four corners of this world, are aligned against God. They are. They are not for the Lord. And so if you look around the world, if you look around through the lens of just the news and all these things, don't be surprised if you're hearing stories of sin and dysfunction and brokenness that don't line up with righteous things of God because they are opposed to him. There are four horns. And they scattered Judah. The other thing, let me just, I'll point out a few words as we go. I won't have time to dig into all of them. Scattering, very, very much a word associated with the exile. Like the Exodus and the exile, like this word of scattering. If you think of how it's normally used of the scattering of sheep. Psalm 44, places like that, we're like sheep that have been scattered. And so when the exile happens, that word becomes the word that kind of connotes the scattering of the nation of Israel. So when that word shows up in the prophets, think exile. These are the nations responsible for the exile. They have opposed God, opposed God's people. And we already found out in Vision 1, they went far beyond what God would have had them do, bringing discipline to his people. They have brought destruction and pain and misery. But that's what these horns represent. Again, I went down this road a little bit in first service, so I will with you guys as well. But let me speculate for a minute. It's easy to read when you read the horns that we're reading a military vision, right? The horn represents power and strength and all those kind of things. And so it's, in my mind, I'm thinking armies, military, battles, fight, war, all those kind of things. I would love to have the conversation with Zechariah. It's like, Zechariah, tell me exactly what you saw when you saw four horns. Remember, Zechariah is a priest. He comes from a priestly family. He switched careers. He's now a prophet. And he sees four horns. Because in Zechariah's world, the only time you would have had sort of experience of four horns is the four horns of the altar. Remember that thing where if you were, you know, fleeing for your life, you could go and cling to one of the horns, the four corners of the altar for safety? That's a moment of four horns. And if that could be in part what the picture is, it actually fits really well with what comes next. I'll explain it in a second. Because the very next thing he sees are four craftsmen. The Lord showed me four craftsmen. And I said, what are these coming to do? And it's a great question. And I think the question is almost asked in that kind of tone. It's like, we got four horns that are threatening in some pretty grave way, powerful enough to scatter the nations, either by military force or, if it represents more of that altar-type language, then by idolatrous worship. In other words, Israel is scattered because they have forsaken the Lord and they have turned to other forms of worship. Could be either, it could actually be both. And I'm actually pretty content that maybe both things are in mind here. And along come four craftsmen in the vision. Some translations, I think, say blacksmiths. Tradespeople would be apt. The word you're going to be most familiar with is carpenter, because Jesus in the Hebrew is he's a carpenter. It doesn't evoke a picture of strength. I think maybe that's why Zechariah asked the question. It's like, we've got four horns, and we got to deal with this. And now all of a sudden, four craftsmen come along? It's like, and you hear the questions, like, what are they going to do? Like, they can't oppose. You would expect if it's horns and animal, like four hunters or something with strength, but four ordinary craftsmen. And they will bring terror into the horns. And they will destroy them. I love that scene. It's maybe my favorite moment so far in the book of Zechariah. Because I bet you, most of the time when God works in powerful ways in our lives, we don't recognize it. It looks way too ordinary. Something comes along that God is going to use in immensely powerful ways, and we're like, what's that going to do? And God just says, oh, just wait, because my power is made perfect in weakness. And I use the weak to confound the strong, and I use the foolish to confound the wise. And there's four horns, and it looks like they're the things that control the world. I'll just send four craftsmen. Because with my power behind them, we can cast them down. Now, pay attention to the raising of head language. In fact, all through this section, there's like raising and lowering. You can kind of see that through the language. And in verse 21, what do they come to do? And these are the horns that scattered Judas, that no one could raise his head. That's actually, I think, the important little phrase there, that raising of the head. Because if you remember some of the language of the Psalms, that God is the lifter of our heads, we sing it. There's in a couple of our chorus. I almost started to hum one. I won't do that to you. That he is the lifter of our heads. In other words, we hang our heads in shame, right? And when there is something bad, that's kind of the image. But God is the one who lifts them up. It's like, you can look because I have grace for you and I can redeem you. That's kind of the imagery of that lowering a head, lifting of the head. And so Israel's heads have been lowered in shame and dismay. No one could raise their head, but God steps in and he brings justice. And he casts down the horn. Look at the language, right? Israel's head's been lowered, but he's going to cast down the horns of the nations who lifted up their horns against the land of Judah to scatter it. Again, that exile, Exodus sort of language. God says, I'm going to come and I'm going to bring justice. The thing you need to know about your God is not only does he bring peace in vision one, he brings justice in vision two. And if you're going through stuff where you're like, this is not fair, this is not right, one day God will bring justice. I don't know the timeline, whether you will live to see the day, but I do know God. And he says, I will smash the horns. And the heads that have been lower, I will lift them up. And maybe he's just going to come to you and say, you've been hanging your head in shame far too long. Because when you look to me and trust me, oh man, I can forgive you and I can bring grace and you can lift your head up again. Third vision, chapter 2. I've lifted my eyes, again, this important little phrase. I lifted my eyes and saw. And a man, behold, a man with a measuring line in his hand. Now, a measuring line is a tool for measurement. It's kind of like, it would evoke in my mind the modern parallel of like a surveyor. If you ever see surveyors out starting to do work and then there's that, oh, it's like, I wonder what they're going to be doing. Please don't do another roundabout on Pleasant Valley Road. Whatever you do, I don't want to see that happen next year because it just opened. It's like so good. But you see that and it's like, okay, something's going to come. So some work is about to happen. And I don't know if it's, you know, a road or underground services or someone's going to build a house, but something's going to happen. The man with the measuring line shows up. Something is about to be built. And so Zechariah says, where are you going? Like, where is the project? Please not Pleasant Valley Road. And he said to me, to measure Jerusalem. Going to build Jerusalem to see its width and its length. Okay, that seems promising because all along God's kind of promised, like, I'm going to bring comfort, I'm going to rebuild the city. But this one is a little bit different because immediately after that, the angel of the Lord, verse 3, who talked with me, came forward, and another angel came forward to meet him. So we got this angelic meeting and then a conversation and some instruction. And here's the instruction. Run and say to that young man, Jerusalem shall be inhabited as villages without walls. Now that's a very strange ancient world scene, because in the ancient world, you don't build a city without walls. No one would live there. It's just, it's too dangerous. There's not safety, not security. That's why if you go and ever travel in any of the ancient world, you see these old wall cities and they're just packed full of houses and they're building up and up and up and the little lanes. And it's like, why didn't they move out? It's like, because it's dangerous. You don't have an unwalled city in the ancient world. But this one is going to be a city without a wall, because it's going to be so vast, which I hope brings to mind some of the pictures from Revelation 21 and 22 of the city that comes down in New Jerusalem. And the description of the dimensions are just so massive. Now, how will they be safe in this city with no walls? Well, I will be to her a wall of fire all around, declares the Lord, and I will be the glory in her midst. There's your answer. It's like, how is it possible to have a city with no walls? Because God says, I'll be the one to protect. I'll be the glory in the middle of it. Again, that end times vision from Revelation. No temple, because God is present. And if the first vision speaks of peace and the second vision speaks of justice, this final vision speaks of the presence of God. And we're going to run out of time real quick, but let me just point out a couple quick things before we celebrate communion. Verse 6. Up, up, flee from the land of the north, declares the Lord, for I have spread you abroad as the four winds of the heaven, declares the Lord. Up. Escape to Jerusalem, you who dwell with the daughter of Babylon. For thus said the Lord of hosts, after his glory has sent me to the nations who plundered you. For he who touches you touches the apple of his eye, literally the pupil of his eye. It's like, you know, have you ever had someone try to like poke you in the eye? Or you go to the doctor and it's like, you just sit there and open your eye and I'm just going to like poke around. It's like, you can't do it, right? God's like, my people are so precious to me. It's like an enemy trying to poke me in the eye. You will get a reaction. But he goes on and he says one more important thing, verse 9. Behold, I will shake my hand over them. That's that language that's lacking. Remember in the first vision? It's quiet, it's still, and we're waiting for God to shake the nations. I will shake my hand over them, and they will become plunder for those who serve them. Now, what does that remind you of? A group of slaves who take plunder from those who are after them. This is Exodus. God's saying in the first part of that vision, I'm going to rebuild Jerusalem. The second part of the vision, there will be a new Exodus. In Luke chapter 9, there's a great scene. It's Luke's account of the transfiguration. Let me just remind you of the conversation that Jesus has. There's two figures that join him, Elijah and Moses. And Luke tells us what they talk about. Luke says they're having a conversation. Your English translation has a footnote. The English translation says they talk to Jesus about his departure. We're thinking, it's like, well, it must be his death or his ascension into heaven. The footnote says Exodus, because literally, it's the Exodus he's going to lead. And I think it's important, because I think what Zechariah is looking down through the annals of history and seeing a day when what he is seeing and what he's experiencing is going to connect with what Jesus is going to do, that he is going to lead an Exodus. Because there is still an oppressor. There is still something that we are slaves to. It's sin and death. And Jesus will lead a way out. He does it by going to the cross. Remember the weakness of a craftsman, of a carpenter? In Zechariah's vision, God sends four carpenters to overcome all the horns. And one day God will send his one and only son, one carpenter. And he will lead an exodus. And he will deliver your soul. And there will be nothing that can oppose him. And you will be able to experience the peace of God and the justice of God and the presence of God forever. And Zechariah brings this incredible news of comfort to these people whose lives are just so out of kilter. Everything has been thrown in turmoil. And he comes along and he says, if you just return to me, you can live with the confidence and the hope of who I am. A God of peace, a God of justice, and a God who will be present in your life. So we have the chance to celebrate communion this morning and remembering that pivotal moment when Jesus went to the cross to accomplish this.